The headlines: Russia says peace talks with Ukraine have made no major breakthroughs so far as the two sides prepare for a new round of negotiations. The United Arab Emirates says Russian oil is needed by energy markets and no producer can substitute its production. And China imposes a lockdown on its financial hub Shanghai in an attempt to contain a surge in coronavirus cases. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Russia and Ukraine are preparing for a new round of face-to-face talks in the Turkish city of Istanbul. Moscow says negotiations have so far made no major breakthrough on the conflict. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says he cannot state any significant achievement yet. However, he says a decision to continue the talks in person is an important step. Russia and Ukraine held their first high-level talks 2 weeks ago in Turkey's Antalya, but failed to reach a consensus. After that, the two sides held regular talks via video conference, but offered scant hopes for any breakthroughs. The new round, which the Turkish president agreed to host during a telephone conversation with his Russian counterpart, is expected to begin on Tuesday. The Kremlin calls alarming U.S. President Joe Biden's remarks that his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin cannot remain in power. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says Moscow will continue to closely monitor statements of the U.S. president. During his visit to Poland on Saturday, Biden dubbed Putin a butcher who, he said, cannot remain in power. Later, the White House tried to downplay the remark, and the president himself said that he had not been calling for regime change. Washington's NATO envoy also said Washington has no policy of regime change in Russia. Moscow, however, responded by saying that the Russian president is elected by the people and is not up to Biden to decide whether he should be leading the country. The United Arab Emirates has poured more cold water on Western efforts to replace Russian energy. It says the energy markets need Russian oil and no producer can substitute its production. The UAE energy minister said OPEC Plus needed to stay together, stay focused, and not allow politics to distract the group. OPEC Plus consists of 23 countries, including Russia. Western nations, including the United States, have been trying to end or slash Europe's reliance on Russian energy resources in response to Moscow's military offensive against Ukraine. Russia is Europe's top oil and gas supplier. Just days ago, the Qatari energy minister also said that his country is currently unable to help Europe with gas deliveries as there is no immediate alternative to Russia. And the Chinese government has imposed a two-stage lockdown on the financial hub Shanghai in a bid to contain the surge in coronavirus cases there. The new round of restrictions includes closing bridges and tunnels at the first stage and restricting highway traffic at the second stage. It will split China's most populous city along the Hangzhou River for 9 days to allow mass testing by healthcare workers. The new measure is taken after the expert COVID team found large-scale infections throughout the city. On Sunday, Shanghai registered a record 3,450 COVID cases, accounting for nearly 70% of the nationwide total. Meanwhile, the announcement of the lockdown has overwhelmed delivery services while supermarkets run low on supplies. It is the biggest COVID-related disruption to hit Shanghai so far. Canada's indigenous people meet Pope Francis in the Vatican asking for an apology for the abuse and death of children in Catholic-run residential schools.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement, apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
It was the Pope's first meeting with the representatives of the native peoples, referred to as the process of healing. But the survivors of residential schools asked the pontiff for free access to church records on the institutions where children were abused. There was no apology yet from the Pope. However, indigenous peoples expect him to visit Canada and make an apology there. Last year, the remains of 215 children were discovered at a former boarding school in British Columbia. Hundreds more unmarked burial sites have been found ever since. The schools, run mostly by the Catholic Church, aim to assimilate Indigenous children between 1830s and 1990s.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another Hashtag Trending. Pope Francis is hosting a group of Canadian Indigenous leaders to discuss the Roman Catholic Church's role in the Canadian residential school system following multiple discoveries of unmarked mass graves at the former sites. The Indigenous elders and residential school survivors say that they expect nothing less than a public apology from the Pope for the sufferings inflicted upon the Indigenous people. They also want to address the role of the Catholic Church in the suppression of Indigenous languages, culture, and spirituality. In June, Pope Francis expressed pain at the discovery of the unmarked graves, but stopped short of offering the apology. Now many are saying that the Pope and the Catholic Church owe much more than a mere apology to start a reconciliation process with the Indigenous people of Canada. Our first tweet of the day comes from Now Is In Effect. The Catholic Church owes Indigenous peoples of Canada much more than an apology. They should disband their church organization at the very least. But clearly followers of the Pope aren't ethical people. Mrs. Carla Robson-David tweeted, I really hope that the Pope will recognize the damage the Catholic Church has done to Indigenous peoples in residential schools. Please apologize to our Indigenous peoples to start the Church's process of reconciliation, recovery. Don't let Canadians down this time. Philip McLeod, excuse the mispronunciation if there was one, if reconciliation is to advance in Canada, the Pope needs to do a lot more than just listen when an Indigenous delegation meets with him this week. And here's another tweet by Ashish Basu. Insightful conversation. The Catholic Church and the Pope owes not only an apology, but reparations to survivors and their families and heirs. The Catholic Church has billions. It is inconceivable that those who supposedly serve God could be so heinous. While the discovery of Canada's unmarked mass graves of Indigenous people goes viral, activists are sounding the alarm on the plight of Canada's marginalized communities. They say that it is completely unacceptable that Indigenous people don't have access to clean drinking water, while Canada is home to 20% of the world's freshwater reserves. Our next comment comes from CJF. She's 80, has never flown on a plane, and she's headed to Rome to ask the Pope for an apology following the abuse she suffered in Canada's residential school system. Over here, we have a tweet by Linda WS. Nearly three-quarters of Canada's 130 residential schools were run by Roman Catholic missionary congregations, which an estimated 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend. And unfortunately, thousands of these children are believed to be dead while attending these institutions. Ryan Reynolds has our next tweet. Canada's home to 20% of Earth's freshwater. There's no acceptable reason Indigenous communities don't have access to clean, safe water. Meanwhile, the discoveries of the unmarked mass graves in Canada renewed a spotlight in the U.S. and stirred strong emotions among tribal communities. An investigation is underway on the role of the Catholic Church in operating Indigenous residential schools and their lasting consequences on Native American communities. Our next tweet in our final batch comes from William Beaulieu. Hashtag US2, due out April 2022, is the interior, that is the account for the Department of the Interiors of the U.S., reports detailing scope of issues involving USA's residential schools as Pontifex, that is the account of the Pope, as Pontifex prepares to visit Canada. The U.S. is just beginning its process of looking into these same crimes against humanity across its portion of North America. A. Smith tweeted, "Remember the 19th century mass killing of the buffalo across North America by the USA government was deliberately carried out to starve and genocide the indigenous native population as part of the government's expansionism program." And over here we have an interesting GIF detailing the U.S. native land loss from 1776 to 1930. Which you can see that the red part is the indigenous population just shrinking down to pretty much nothing. And it is posted by Socialism for All. They wrote, "It's important to remember that the theft of land from indigenous nations to create the USA is not a long ago historical event, but a very recent one. And colonization is ongoing. Hashtag land back." That'll do it for another edition of Hashtag Trending. Many thanks. Time to get back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
The North Korean leader says his country will continue to reinforce its defense capabilities, vowing to build up formidable striking capabilities and overwhelming military force. Kim Jong-un says only unstoppable military power can prevent a war, ensure the security of the country, and deter threats and blackmail by imperialists. He made the remarks during a meeting with North Korean scientists and technocrats involved in the Thursday launch of the country's largest intercontinental ballistic missile. In response, the U.S. imposed fresh sanctions on Pyongyang. Washington also imposed sanctions on Russian individuals and entities, accusing them of providing sensitive materials for North Korea's missile program. North Korea has tested nearly a dozen weapons this year. Our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, explains why North Korea has recently intensified its missile tests.
And we've seen also a diversification of North Korea's missile arsenal, with hypersonic missiles and cruise missiles being added to their sort of catalog of missile capabilities. Now, the reason that we're seeing this, you know, uptick in North Korea's missile development is that over the past few years, following the failed summitry between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump, Kim Jong-un really hasn't received anything. He has kept his word to have a moratorium on long-range missile tests and nuclear tests, with the understanding that the U.S. would respond with a relief of United Nations Security Council sanctions and overtures toward meaningful negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea that really haven't materialized. Also, it's a message to South Korea, which has a new president that's set to be inaugurated in May.
Palestinian resistance groups have blasted a summit hosted by Israel and attended by officials from four Arab countries, as well as the top U.S. diplomat in occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian groups have condemned the summit as a symbol of collusion with Israeli plots against Palestinians.
Top diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, and the United States hold a summit in the Negev Desert. Foreign ministers of the Arab countries hold talks with Israeli officials to discuss bilateral relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also took part in the Negev summit.
Israel is trying to achieve something that it basically has not achieved for most of its history. Namely, it is to gang up on the Palestinians and the Arab countries that support the Palestinians.
The controversial summit comes as Tel Aviv is pressing ahead with its expansionist policies, including settlement construction on occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the meeting. Hamas said the meeting is a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots against Palestine and its people. Hamas reiterated its absolute rejection of all forms of normalization with the occupying regime, stressing that such meetings only serve the enemy in perpetuating its continuous aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites. The resistance movement also called on the Arab countries that signed the Abraham Accords with Israel to reconsider their move to honor their historical responsibilities to protect Al-Quds. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad said on Sunday that the Negev summit reflects the loss of Arab identity of all those who agreed to be part of the enemy's normalization project. Meanwhile, the Deputy Secretary General of Bahrain's Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society also condemned the meeting, warning that the Bahraini regime was making a miscalculation. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in 2020 under U.S. brokered deals. Bahrain and Morocco followed suit, while Sudan also agreed to normalize ties with Israel. Also recently, the Saudi Crown Prince described Israel as a potential ally. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Like steps with the spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health.
In the limelight.
The haphazard evacuation of tens of thousands of people from Afghanistan last year, as U.S. troops pulled out of the country, left little time to prepare ORR facilities, which are accustomed to housing Central American children and teens. The COVID-19 pandemic created additional complications. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Melissa Sanchez and Anna Clark, writers. This article is published under the heading, Nearly 200 Children Who Fled Afghanistan Without Family Are Stuck in U.S. Custody. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Seven months after the fall of Kabul, shelters in the U.S. caring for children evacuated without their parents are experiencing unprecedented violence, while workers at the facilities have struggled to respond to the young Afghans' trauma. Some children have run away, punched employees, and stopped eating. Others have tried to kill themselves. At one shelter, ProPublica has learned some children reported being hurt by employees and sexually abused by others. At least three shelters in Michigan and Illinois have shut down or paused operations after taking in large groups of Afghan children, prompting federal officials to transfer them from one facility to another, further upending their lives. This is not acceptable, said Nahid Samadi Behram, U.S. Country Director for Nonprofit Women for Afghan Women, which provides mentors to children in custody in New York. These children left their homes with a dream to be stable, to be happy, to be safe. If we cannot offer that here in the U.S., that is the big failure. ProPublica reported in October on serious problems at Chicago shelter that took in dozens of young Afghans. Since then, the troubles have been found in U.S. shelter system that are more widespread. This account is based on law enforcement records, internal documents, and interviews with nearly 2,000 people who have worked with or have talked with the children in facilities across the country, including shelter administrators and employees, as well as interpreters, attorneys, and volunteers. Advocates for the children acknowledge that the Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR, the federal agency responsible for overseeing the nation's shelters for unaccompanied immigrant minors, is navigating an exceptional challenge. The haphazard evacuation of tens of thousands of people from Afghanistan last year as U.S. troops pulled out of the country left little time to prepare ORR facilities, which are accustomed to housing Central American children and teens. The COVID-19 pandemic created additional complications. In all, some 1,400 unaccompanied Afghan minors were brought to the U.S. last year and placed in ORR custody. Of those, more than 1,200 have gone to live with sponsors, typically relatives or family friends. Nearly all the remaining 190 are teenage boys with nobody there who can take them with. As of March 8, more than 80 Afghan children had been in ORR custody for at least 5 months, according to government data analyzed by the National Center for Youth Law. In a system that normally houses children for about a month, the young Afghans have been waiting in what seems like never-ending detention. It's unclear how or when children will be reunited with their families. The U.S. State Department is working to obtain travel documents for parents who remain in Afghanistan, a spokesperson said, but coordinating departures from Kabul has proven challenging. The ORR said it has placed 56 of the 190 children in its custody into long-term or transitional foster care as of this week and is recruiting more families to take them in. The ORR official who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the agency is doing its best to support the Afghan children by providing interpreters, mental health services, additional staffing, and in recent months, Afghan-American mentors. But those efforts won't change the reality for a child that their parent is hiding from Taliban or that their family has died or that they are grappling with some really terrible things that nobody should have to grapple with. I do struggle to know what else we could do doing that we've already not trying to do. And the ORR may soon face another challenge. With the Biden administration's announcement that the U.S. will accept 100,000 Ukrainians fleeing war, people who work in the system are bracing for the children who may arrive without their parents. On a cold and cloudy evening in early January, 19 boys were shuttled in vans to a shelter run by the nonprofit Samaritas in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Employees at the shelter had heard that they might receive Afghan children but thought they would have 2 or 3 weeks to prepare for their arrival. Instead, they had 24 hours notice, according to one worker. A federal emergency intake site that housed dozens of Afghan children almost 85 miles away in Michigan had abruptly shut down, scattering children to facilities across the country, including Samaritas. The shelter was not ready. One Samaritas employee said everything from the food to the reading material to the grievance procedures and rules, everything that we have was set up for Central American kids, and we are not ready. On a given day, some 10,000 or so children and teens are in ORR custody around the country, the vast majority of them from Central America. Facilities that receive them tend to have employees who know their language and culture. Workers often speak Spanish or are Latin American immigrants or children of immigrants. They understand what motivates Central American teens to immigrate each year, pursuing a better education, fleeing gang violence, and earning dollars to support families. The children too often know what to expect because they've heard stories from friends and relatives who immigrated before them. They know it will be about 30 days in ORR's custody before they're sent to live with a sponsor. The Afghan kids were a completely different story, said a former worker at a Pittsburgh shelter run by the nonprofit Holy Family Institute. I felt so sorry for them. They have been there 3-4 months and they still did not know if they would ever see their families again. The pivot to housing Afghan children left shelters flat-footed. Many needed prayer rocks, halal meat, and connections to local Muslims who could lead Friday prayers. Even with interpreters who spoke Pashto or Dari, communication between children and employees was very difficult, leading to misunderstandings and mistrust. In the hours before the Afghan children arrived in Grand Rapids, the Samaritas worker said staff members were scrambling, "Okay, like, what language do you like to speak?" It was a culture shock for them. It was a culture shock for us. Samaritas Chief Operations Office Kevin Van Den Bosch said, "There were many unexpected complications, but we looked at the challenge. If not us, who is going to do it?" Employees at several shelters described the trauma among the youth as more severe than anything they had seen. Children are desperate to call home to check on their parents and other relatives, some of whom worked for the U.S. government or for contractors and are now potential targets. Some feel guilty for being in the U.S., while their families fear for their lives in Afghanistan. After the Afghan children arrived in Samaritas, Grand Rapids, police responded nearly every other day to calls for incidents like missing persons, suicide threats, fights, and assaults. The police reports were unavailable, but internal shelter records document many of those incidents. One boy put a rope around his neck, saying, acting like he wanted to hang himself. Another day, a boy tried to suffocate another child with a plastic bag. A few days later, a worker found the boy scratching his forearm. He told her that when his body is in pain, it prevents his head from thinking about his problems. Meanwhile, Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the state's Children Protective Services, is investigating allegations related to Samaritas, though it's not clear what the allegations involve. Department spokesperson Bob Witten said the agency was prohibited by law from disclosing details. Samaritas officials said that while the nonprofit could not provide information about the allegations, the agency follows robust safety protocols to protect the youth in its care. That includes background checks, cameras at the facility, and safety plans for children at risk of self-harm. Advocates said the struggles of some of the Afghan children should have been anticipated. Saman Hamidi Azar, who visits children in ORR facilities as a volunteer with Afghan Refugee Relief, a community organization in California, said even children who have no prior traumatic experiences would begin to show signs of distress at this point, being in shelter care for this long. There is nowhere to pinpoint blame except for the manner in which Afghanistan is evacuated way too fast. No one was prepared on the ground. No one could have expected what happened.
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The condition of the Shia movement, which was a movement led by the Imams, a movement in the political sense, is an activity, an organized activity against the authority, to overthrow an authority, a regime, and to establish a new government. That is, of course, the ultimate example and the most drastic example of change that a movement would be moving towards. But a movement can only be a movement if it's about change. If it's about keeping status quo, then it wouldn't be a movement. Movement only makes sense when you're moving away from status quo. Of course, there are many movements that identify as movements, and the only difference is the people who rule. In other words, there have been movements to overthrow regimes, overthrow governments, overthrow kings, overthrow dynasties, and the objective of that has been some form of change, but that change is not the change in status quo in terms of the ideology, in terms of oppression, in terms of anything meaningful to the masses, to the people. The only thing that is different is that the movement is about overthrowing that particular dynasty, that particular individual, to put in power someone else. The movement of the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in, was not that. The movement of the Shia has not been that. The movement of the revolution, which is the continuation of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt, is not about removing the Shah from Iran and establishing rule for another person. It's about changing status quo from it being a rule that is based on whims and desires, whoever that may be, to the rule of God's law and the rule of God. That is the change that is intended. In Western governments, in non-Western governments, but Western governments today are the focal point. They are the ones that people generally look at and see and look up to in many cases. The changes that happen supposedly in a democratic way, where people participate in elections, one candidate in a particular party in the U.S., the two-party system, the politicians compete with one another. They create a movement called a campaign during the campaign season to become the candidate of one of those two parties. And then they campaign against each other and against the sitting president to bring a different person in. But the policies, the direction, everything, and as we said, the essential aspect or the essential and fundamental part of that rule, which is rule based on whims, based on desires, based on interests of the person and the party and the class that are ruling and governing, that remains the same. One person goes, another person comes. The direction remains that of whatever is in the interest of the elite and those who are in power, be it the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. The movement of the Ahlul Bayt was to change that. The movement of the Ahlul Bayt is to change that, to become the rule of God. No one has the right to govern people in a way that is in the ruler's best interest. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's laws are put in place. God has given us these laws. إن أحسنتم أحسنتم لأنفسكم وإن أسأتم فلها. Those laws are given for our own benefit. If we abide by these laws, we will benefit from it. If we don't, we will be hurt. And this is about any individual that implements those laws, and on a societal level, on a global level, for all people, if people implement those laws, if governments implement divine laws and govern people's lives based on God's instructions, people will benefit. No one has the right to come forth and establish laws that are in the interest of a few, and the masses don't benefit from that materially as well as spiritually. The rule of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the rule of Islam, the rule of the Ahlul Bayt, the rule of the representatives of the Ahlul Bayt means that the movement of the Ahlul Bayt that was there after Imam al-Mujtaba salamullah alayhi, who to the best of his ability continued to hold on to the power because God had given him that taklif, that responsibility to hold on to power based on and through means that are legitimate, not through illegitimate means like Muawiyah. He held on to the best of his ability and he was capable. However, holding on to government the correct way, the legitimate way, is for the people to want it, support it. When the people did not support any longer, then it was no longer his responsibility to continue pushing the people in the right direction, as they have refused to accept that. And if they refuse, knowing what it is, knowing that this is their leader, they reject it, the leader doesn't have any responsibilities any longer to rule. And if a ruler or leader decides to push and grab a hold and keep power in his claws, even and despite the fact that the people are not supportive, then that would not be a legitimate way of maintaining governance and authority any longer. Imam al-Mujtaba salamullah alayhi, and from him onwards, the imams worked on a public movement, a popular movement, a movement that involved giving people information, knowledge, understanding of what government is, what is right, what God has said in regards to the nation of Islam, the nation of the Prophet, what they should do, who should rule, and so on and so forth. This movement to educate people in that regard and to create a popular movement, meaning a movement that stems from Islam, that stems from the Quran, that stems from the teachings of the Prophet, that stems from the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, Salamullah alayhim ajma'in. Getting that information to the masses, to the people, so that the people rise, بالقسط, as the Quran said in Surah Al-Hadid, ليقوم الناس بالقسط, so that the people would rise. This is what the Ahlul Bayt worked on. Imam Al-Mujtaba worked on that. Imam Al-Husayn worked on that before Karbala. In Karbala, he started his part. He saw that it was his taklif to rise. Whether the people are ready to actually move towards overthrowing the regime or they are not. If they are, the movement will end up one way, that rise that he did, that he moved towards Mecca initially and then towards Kufa. If the people would have supported, that rise would have ended up in a different way. And if they don't support, the rise is still going to be there. And Imam al-Husayn salamullah alayhi had a responsibility that for the occasion of Muharram to discuss and remind ourselves and each other regarding that. Imam Zain al-Abidin continued, Imam al-Baqir salamullah alayhi continued, Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi continued, and you arrive at Imam al-Kadhim salamullah alayhi's time. He continues, and the rest of the Imams have continued. The 12th Imam is continuing with that. He is working, he is at work day in and day out in ways that we cannot see, and he knows, and we hope that we are able to see in the near future.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyumun Rauf Saburun Majid. صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Researchers are trying to establish whether existing COVID-19 vaccines and treatments can prevent lasting symptoms. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Heidi Ledford Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Can Drugs Reduce the Risk of Long COVID? What Scientists Know So Far. Here's the story. In the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, urologist and clinical epidemiologist Kari Tikkanen found his schedule full of canceled surgeries, so he had some time to kill. Do whatever you feel is most useful, his boss at the University of Helsinki advised him. So Tikkanen threw himself into running clinical trials for COVID-19 TRAPIs. From the start, before the world learned of long COVID, Tikkanen saw a need to follow study participants for months after the recovery. He wanted to monitor long-term side effects of the medicines. He says, very soon it became clear it's not only about safety. Now Tikkanen and a handful of others are hoping to learn more about whether treatments given during the acute phase of COVID-19 can reduce the risk of experiencing symptoms months later. It's an urgent and pressing health need that people need to start focusing on, says intensive care specialist Charlotte Summers at the University of Cambridge, UK. Research into long COVID, which is also known as post-acute sequelae of COVID-19 and is usually defined as COVID-19 symptoms that last longer than 3 months, has lagged behind the studies of the acute phase of infection. People who experience long COVID live with a wide array of symptoms, ranging from mild to severely debilitating. Researchers have propose a variety of causes for the condition, from lingering viral reservoir to autoimmunity to tiny blood clots. Many think that a mix of these factors is to blame. It could take a while to get going on any serious mechanistic long COVID research, says immunologist Danny Altman at Imperial College London, adding it's hard to piece the big picture together. Thus far, vaccines are the best way to prevent long COVID. COVID-19 vaccines reduce the risk of SARS-CoV infection, and they might lessen the risk of long COVID after a breakthrough infection in someone who has been vaccinated. Several studies have looked at this question. Although they have yielded divergent results, the overall trend suggests that vaccination could reduce the risk of long COVID by about half among those who became infected after vaccination. For example, one study that has not yet been peer-reviewed found that vaccination reduced the chances of developing long COVID symptoms by about 41% in more than 3,000 double-vaccinated participants who were later infected with SARS-CoV-2. But that still leaves too many people at risk of getting long COVID, says Altman. Half is not as good as I thought it would be, he says, adding, I was thinking and hoping that long COVID would be a thing of the past. Beyond vaccination, it's unclear whether any existing COVID-19 therapy has an effect on long COVID risk. In theory, a drug that reduces disease severity might reduce the severity of long-term symptoms, says Altman. But long COVID is not always associated with serious acute illness. There are loads of people out there who are really destroyed by long COVID and had symptomatic or near asymptomatic infections, he says, adding, it's really hard to grapple with. Nevertheless, some studies plan to look at the impact of early treatment with antiviral drugs on long COVID. A clinical trial called Panoramic has been testing the effects of oral antiviral molnupiravir, developed by Merck in New Jersey, and Biotherapeutics in Miami on COVID-19 severity. Although it is not the primary goal of the study, researchers will gather data from participants at 3 and 6 months after treatment, which could determine whether the drug affects long COVID risk. Researchers are hoping to find out whether more treatments can reduce the risk of long COVID. A large UK-based trial called Heal COVID is testing two drugs that target the cardiovascular system in people who have been hospitalized with COVID-19. One called Apixaban is an anticoagulant. The other, Astrovastatin, is a cholesterol-lowering medication thought to reduce inflammation in blood vessels. The study will investigate whether either treatment reduces hospitalizations and deaths in the year after people are first discharged from hospital. Nearly one-third of people who are discharged after treatment for COVID-19 are readmitted within 6 months, and 12% die within 6 months of their initial discharge. And when we looked at what was most plausibly leading to death after hospitalization, it was probably the cardiopulmonary effects, says Summers, who is leading the study. At the University of Chicago in Illinois, pulmonologist and critical care physician Ayeji Adesoy has observed a possible increase in the accumulation of a scar tissue called fibrosis in the lungs well after the acute infection in people who were hospitalized with COVID-19 and required supplemental oxygen. He is now testing a drug called sirolimus, an immune-suppressing drug that is sometimes given to organ transplant recipients in such people in the hope that it will prevent the migration of cells that promote fibrosis in the lung. By their nature, long COVID studies require patience. One commonly accepted definition of long COVID is the persistence of certain symptoms for more than 12 weeks after acute infection. Altman is optimistic that this year will yield advances, but cautions against reading too much into small trials that might not yield the statistically meaningful results. There is such pressure, he says. There is this incredibly pressing and desperate need. We all feel that anxiety.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
The fourth criterion is diligence in the face of the enemy. We should know the enemy, and we should be sensitive in the face of the enemy's moves. Those who were on the front lines during the sacred defense era know that there were some individuals within our bases who followed, with the help of their agents, every small move made by the enemy. Then they would focus on it. Imagine that the enemy has made a particular move. They would ask, what is his goal and why did he do it? They used to find a reason. they were diligent towards the enemy's moves. We should know the enemy and identify his plans. We should be diligent about his plots, his words, and his statements. And we should find an antidote for the poison that he will probably use. And we should be ready to foil his move. This is sensitivity in the face of the enemy. Well, what is the opposite of this sensitivity? One is that some people deny the existence of the enemy. When we speak about an enemy, such individuals say, "You are suffering from an illusion or an illusion of conspiracy." In my opinion, bringing up this illusion of conspiracy is a conspiracy in itself.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In order to decrease sensitivities, they say, "Who is the enemy? Or which enmity?" They deny the most obvious things. What we are saying is that America is the enemy of the revolution. It is the nature of global imperialism to show enmity towards a system such as the Islamic Republic. Their interests are 180 degrees different from each other. Global imperialism is about treachery, waging wars, creating and organizing terrorist groups, suppressing freedom-seeking groups, and exerting pressure over the oppressed, such as the oppressed people of Palestine and countries like Palestine. This is the nature of global imperialism. Take note, it is 100 years now that America and England have been pressuring the people of Palestine. They have been doing so before the formation of the Zionist regime in the year 1948 and after that, till this day.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.